From UFOs to ghosts and government cover-ups, history is riddled with unexplained events. You can turn back now or learn the stuff they don't want you to know.
Hello, welcome back to the show. My name is Matt.
And I'm Ben, and we are joined, as always, by our super producer, Noel the Highwayman Brown, and high fives across the internet if you got that reference. But today, Matt, we're also joined by a special guest, a good friend of the shows, and a good friend of you and I both, outside of this whole stuff they want you to know thing.
Ladies and gentlemen, I present to you Mr. Scott Benjamin.
Well, thank you very much, guys. I appreciate the offer to be here on your show today.
Oh, yeah, we appreciate it even more. But let's not get in a contest about appreciation here, Scott, because I am thrilled to have you on our show. Now, longtime listeners, you may know that Scott and I worked together on a different show called Car Stuff. And if you watch our Stuff They Don't Want You to Know videos, then there's a chance that you caught Scott on his first appearance with Stuff They Don't Want You to Know, which was a video podcast.
Yeah, a very general episode about car conspiracies, mm-hmm. Just all the car conspiracies.
Feels like that was a long time ago, doesn't it?
I think it was,
well,
man.
It was, yeah.
Do you remember what we were looking at, like pavement conspiracies?
Oh, I can't. Oh, it was the water car, I believe.
Water-powered car.
Sure.
Which you can check out for more. Check out our audio and our video for more information on that. But today, Scott, we asked you over to do the audio component of a video that we also recently made. A lot of folks might not know this, but we're pretty big true crime fans, like all four of us, actually. So Noel, Matt, Scott, and myself. And we were looking into a listener suggestion that we've received from several people, including Jimmy C. on Twitter, which was the Highway of Tears. And Scott, when we started looking into this, we knew we had to get you on board, if at all possible.
Oh, well, I felt like it was a right fit, too, because I have an interest in the case. I have not read anything prior to when you mentioned it to me, but I've been digging into this deeply for the last few weeks. The interstate system and police, functions, mm-hmm. And I'm fascinated by the whole case. I really am, and I can't wait to even get even more information about this, even after this podcast. So,
right,
always yeah,
we,
looking.
We have listeners who will no doubt be writing into us and giving us even more little tidbits that we mm-hmm. will not cover in this episode.
Oh, especially sure. Canadian listeners. Mm-hmm. Well, let's start at the beginning, as the Mad Hatter said to Alice. I think it was the Mad Hatter. What is the Highway of Tears?
Well, the Highway of Tears is about a 450-mile section of Highway 16 that runs between Prince George and Prince Rupert, and that's in British Columbia, Canada, of course. That's like the northern part, I guess, of British Columbia.
Right, Yellowhead Highway 16. For everybody else outside of, Myanmar, Namibia, and the U.S., that's 724 kilometers.
Oh, very good, Ben.
That's nice. And this stretch of highway, it passes through a lot of what are called First Nation communities along mm-hmm. this highway. So these are Aboriginal peoples who live on the land there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, about a dozen small communities. And here's the thing, Matt. You may get a picture of this in your head if you haven't heard of the Highway of Tears before. And that picture, if you close your eyes and you imagine this, if you're seeing a place that is very rural, you are correct. There's not much in the way of public transit, right? There aren't any bus systems. There's not a train. And also, historically, there has been a struggle with poverty in these communities, so a lot of people don't own cars.
Yeah, very small towns, very sparse, very scattered, so long distances in between that are very desolate, especially at night. These are dark, densely wooded areas mm-hmm. that are easy to lose yourself on. You know, you're able to go just off the highway, and there's, I think they said it's like 4 or 5 to 1, the miles of road. So a mile of paved road, there's like 5 unpaved miles of road right next to it.
Right.
There's logging communities everywhere. It's just logging camps, I should say. Mm-hmm. But, so of course logging roads go along with that, and a lot of those are just, again, desolate, rugged roads that are way, way off the main stretch.
So why are we here today to talk about this rural road in British Columbia? I mean, what's the deal? There are rural roads everywhere.
Well, as you may have guessed already, there's been a series of disappearances and murders that have happened along this highway. Now, the number, when I tell you this number, it's not going to be the big number, because there's a much bigger number, but police say that there have been 18 victims since 1969 on the Highway of Tears. Now, you might think that's not a whole lot, really, when you consider that that is about four decades of time.
But as we'll learn later, that's really about how they're measuring, right?
Correct.
From how close to the highway did these people disappear?
Exactly. Yeah, there's some strict parameters that they put into place, and we'll tell you about the team that decided who is officially a victim of the Highway of Tears, and then all these other cases that are not officially Highway of Tears victims. And that's kind of the interesting, the meat of this whole story is that it's much, much bigger than anybody really thinks.
Right. And there are also allegations of cover-ups. There is stuff they don't want you to know in this case. There's endemic, or maybe I should say systemic racism that's involved. Mm-hmm. Let's start with the first victim, a lady named Gloria Moody. At the young age of 26 in 1969, October 25th, she leaves a bar near Williams Lake. And her body, when it's discovered, is at in the woods near a cattle ranch, right? About 10 kilometers away. We should note at this time that this is, in retrospect, considered the first official Highway of Tears murder. However, at the time, it was not given, it's fair to say it was not given adequate investigation or attention of law enforcement because of the systemic racism we've mentioned at the time, which, just to get a picture of this, Matt, that's something that really intrigued you, right?
Yes, systemic racism against the Aboriginal people, you know, in some ways by the Canadian government, because there are these things, these boarding schools called residential schools, that children anywhere from ages 7 to 15, I believe it was, would be sometimes taken away from their family by force, sent to these residential schools where they would be, I think the quote, at least from this documentary that we watched called The Highway of Tears, where they would kill the Indian inside of them. So they would deprive them from the culture of their family, from the culture of their people. And, you know, they wouldn't allow them to dress certain ways. And they kind of just devalued that part, right, to try and assimilate them into the community.
And this is a school that operated for something like 150 years.
Right.
So you've got generations of students going through this school. And I say students loosely. It's kids going through this that are being isolated from their family, being isolated from their culture, not really knowing who they are as they grow up.
Right. And how does this tie into the Highway of Tears?
Well, because the vast majority of victims up until, I think, 2002 is the date that was cited. I know we're jumping a little ahead there, but most of them were Aboriginal women who were going missing.
Sure, yeah. And the reason is that you find that a lot of these women are unable to afford vehicles. And it comes back to public transportation and the need to get between those remote villages or those remote towns that we talked about on this highway, because that's the connecting point.
Mm-hmm. And it's too far to walk in a reasonable distance. You don't have a car, so you have one solution, right, guys?
Well, two solutions. One that's not so great. Greyhound Bus operates a line on Highway 16, but it's infrequent and it doesn't run as often as they would like.
And you have to be near a hub, right?
Yeah, they would like shuttles or something like that, but that's not the case. So Ben, the other option is the one you're talking about,
right?
Which is what?
Hitchhiking. And we actually did on Car Stuff we call them mystery shows. We did one recently on hitchhiking that led to some unexpectedly moral or profound discussions of morality.
It was a bit of an uncomfortable podcast to do, really.
It
sort of was because of, you know, the moral issues. I mean, you want to say, I'll help anybody that's in need and, you know, no problem, but you've got that little bit of fear that right. still lives within you. That, you know, you've been told all your life, don't pick up hitchhikers. Don't pick up that guy on the side of the road on the rainy night, you know, as you're driving past him.
Sure.
But then again, you just saw a car that was broken down half a mile behind, and you know that guy's probably coming from there.
But
should
it's
help
still
him
a gamble.
Yeah.
I mean, unless you've got some kind of segregated car, like a police
sure.
cruiser or something where they can't access your
oh, sure.
cabin.
But you know, we're on the other side of this, though. We're talking about,
right.
you know, the ones in
yes.
danger are the ones that are the walkers, the ones that are
yes.
trying to get from town to town, trying
mm-hmm.
to see friends, trying to get to college campuses.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of times these victims will be portrayed as high-risk victims. They'll say that, you know, of course the hitchhiking is high-risk, but they will also say that I kind of lump in with that, you know, some of these are maybe runaway teens. Some of
sure.
them are... they might use the word prostitutes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's not the case with every one of these, clearly. I'm not saying that might not be the case with some of them. There's also, you know, the possibility that it's just people that have been somehow socially marginalized, people that
right.
are homeless. And I know in those communities, it's probably very rare to actually have a homeless person, but it's a possibility as
yeah.
well. And that happens here in the United States
mm-hmm.
too. And we're going to tie all this together later.
Yeah, yeah, we are.
yeah.
We are because, okay, so first murder, 1969, murders are continuing, or excuse me, disappearances, I guess, if we want to split some hairs about it. And these are not getting any national attention. They're not getting any real regional attention. So how many decades? 1969, 79, 89, 99. It is not until 2002 when a young lady named Nicole Hoare, H-O-A-R, goes missing. This is in 2002. She is white. She is not a First Nations member. So this was the first Highway of Tears cases to be covered in the papers of the time, like Edmonton Journal, Vancouver Sun, Globe and Mail. And then the police really started investigating these as not just quote-unquote isolated incidents.
Okay, and she's not the very first white victim, however.
That's true,
there have been
yeah.
others that were Caucasian that had fallen victim to this, but this one did get a tremendous amount of media coverage, and there was some raised eyebrows about that.
Yeah, wait, you're right, because thank you for clarifying, too. She was the first person to get national attention for the story. She was not the first non-First Nations person.
Yeah, and also... Okay, another little caveat here that we have to add is that I think they said the majority of the women on the list are Aboriginal. So, you know, greater than 50%. I haven't really gone through the numbers here and figured out what percentage
sure.
of these crime or of these cases, rather. But, yeah, the majority are Aboriginal women.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and additionally, we always have to think about it in these terms. These are just the people we know about. There could easily be more people that have disappeared, not just on Highway 16, but on Highways 19, 97, and 5. One of the things we did in our recent video is we talked about five things you should know about the Highway of Tears. And that was number one on our list. We don't know how many people have been killed. We're going to get to suspects and leads and why the three of us, well, four of us, including Noel, believe that there's more than one killer here, but no one really knows. We are outnumbered by questions in this case. Just briefly, while we're talking about the amount of people, let's talk about this, let's talk about why the Native communities and the authorities, the RCMP, have a different body count.
I'll say that RCMP, Royal Canadian Mounted Police, right?
Yes, the Mounties.
And they have a different body count because they have identified – well, okay, this goes back to the EPANA force. So I guess we have to talk about EPANA at
we
this
do.
Point.
Yeah,
okay,
yeah,
so
yeah.
EPANA is a task force that was formed in 2006, and it was used or rather implemented to determine if there was a serial killer, and they only knew about, you know, they were thinking maybe one at this point,
mm-hmm.
if a serial killer was in fact working the highway, was using this as his hunting ground. And they probably at the time were suspecting that, you know, there's more than one, but couldn't really say anything. They didn't have a set number of cases in mind either. They knew that lots of women were disappearing
mm-hmm.
from this highway area. They couldn't put an exact number on it yet until they gave it sort of a set of parameters, something that could kind of narrow down the focus of EPANA.
Mm-hmm.
And so these three key points were, and I think we mentioned these in the video too, but female victims only.
Right.
And then the next characteristic, I guess, would be that they were involved in a high-risk activity, as we just talked mm-hmm. about, hitchhiking or prostitution or whatever it happens to be. And then there's also, Matt, as you said, the one-mile rule. And
yes.
the one-mile rule is what really angers a lot of people in mm-hmm. these communities, because mm-hmm. the EPANA task force gets all the media focus. It gets the attention. When it launched, it had a $5 million budget. It had 70 officers attached to it. It was like they're finally doing something. They're gonna really work this case. They're gonna find out what's happening to, as the locals thought, 40 or 50 cases or something like that, in the area, because there's women missing all the time from this
right.
area.
Right.
Well, what EPANA did with these three characteristics or these three points, these three criteria that people had to meet, or that these cases had to meet, it narrowed it down so finely that it only allowed for the 18 cases that we're talking about today to be counted as official Highway of Tears disappearances. And that really caused a lot of friction in the communities, because they said, well, okay, that's 18, and they're important, but what about the other 40 that you're not talking about?
Well, yeah, because right. as we said, this main highway goes there, but then you've got dirt roads that go off of this road in all directions for a long, long way. Then they meet roads that are also parallel and perpendicular.
Sure. That's why we mentioned the logging camps, because
right?
it's so easy to get more than a mile off the road. Well, I mean, it's difficult, but it's more easy.
Yes.
More
if
easy
you're in
to
a car.
Do that. Well, yeah, it's easy to do that. And then to imagine if you're trying to lose a body, dump a body somewhere, you're going to want to do that somewhere off of the main highway, typically.
Mm-hmm.
So the ones that were found on the highway or disappeared from the highway, that's a rare situation.
Right.
I mean, a relatively rare situation, because, mm-hmm. I mean, 18 out of, what locals claim to be 50 or so.
Right. Yeah, and again, only the ones that people know about. In this documentary that we watched, that we checked out together, there's several just horrifying moments where you'll see someone in one of the communities along Highway 16 say, my sister disappeared or was mm-hmm. murdered, and her body wasn't found in the right place, or the authorities just didn't treat it as related. And
that has to be so maddening.
Oh,
right.
Yeah.
And I understand that, a category for someone posthumously is not going to change the fact that they are dead, but it does affect this investigation, because, ladies and gentlemen, even now, okay, this string of murders that starts in 1969, I think maybe beforehand too, whatever this is, something about Highway 16 has become kind of like a lake in a savanna where predators flock. And so from 1969, or whenever it actually begins, all the way to the present day, of these 18 cases, how many are solved?
Just one. Only one of those cases is solved. And we'll tell you, we can talk about the one that they did solve too, but there's a few more numbers I think that will shock the listeners. Five of those 18 cases are still officially listed as missing cases. There's no body that has been found yet. So, even though they're one of the official 18 EPANA cases, again, five of them are still considered as missing. And those missing dates go back to 1983. So anyone between 1969 that went missing and 1983 had been found.
Mm-hmm.
The missing ones begin around 1983 up till about 2005. There's a lot. Just the amount of information that this case, or these cases rather, has generated is mm-hmm. is enormous. I mean, it fills a warehouse for the RCMP. They have something like 750 boxes of evidence just for those 18 cases that we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So they really are digging into this and getting a lot of leads, a lot of information, a lot of interviews, gathering evidence, whatever they can. It's not that they're not trying. It's just that it's such a difficult thing to do, because, I mean, again, we said it's 450 miles of territory.
Right.
It is, just this densely wooded forest area. I mean, on either side of the road, it's desolate areas. It's dark. It's damp. It's, you know, of course it snows. There's a lot going against them in this case. There's deep lakes that are just off the road. It's just the terrain doesn't lend itself to finding someone easily when they do go missing. Right. And I know I'm probably just going a bunch of different directions here, but there's so much about this case that just doesn't feel right.
I think I see what you're saying, Scott, but what exactly would you say doesn't, what's given you the spider sense?
Yeah, I guess it's just okay, I know it's being handled. I know that they are looking into this, and they have a vested interest in making this work. Of course they want their EPANA task force to mm-hmm. be successful. They want to do this for the community, for the people, but the people are saying, you know, the locals, as you'll see in that documentary or whatever you read, because I've read a bunch about this case in the last few weeks, you'll find that there's a great distrust of the police force in that area. And I can't quite put my finger on exactly what it is, but it goes back to the way that they're treated at these residential schools, the way that they feel that they're stuck in these impoverished regions, you know, these communities, it's almost like Indian reservations here in the United States. It's almost like it's an island upon itself. Each little community is like that.
Additionally, now this is a very touchy subject, but because we don't know how many killers are working in this area or how many killers use it as a hunting ground, it's also possible that someone in authority could have committed or been involved with the commitment of some of these murders and disappearances. And when I say that at this point, folks, I say that purely on the hypothetical, side of the question or the concept. I don't have, and I don't think any of us have found any proof that there's anything other than, you know, a history of negligence at worst on law enforcement side. And then in the past few decades, there's never been somebody caught, as a member of, the mounted police or anything. So the true crime or the crime novelist in me just sees that as a possibility. But there's whether or not that's a possibility, it needs to be said.
Well, this goes right back to, I mean, the Jack the Ripper days when they suspected that it could have been anyone from a surgeon to royalty to an artist to a police officer. Of course, they're going to suspect the authorities in this as well because they have the inside knowledge of, you know, where the patrols are going to be at what time. And they kind of have like I'd hate to say it, like a backstage pass to what's going on behind the scenes and seeing all that and knowing, all right, well, here's my way around that. I can outsmart you. It's simple.
Right, like the Long Island serial killer is suspected to have some sort of knowledge of crime scene investigations.
Just to jump in really fast, guys, with an example of how perhaps the authority in this area views women of, I mean, okay, this is in no way a blanket statement, but this is an example of the way the Aboriginal women are treated. So this guy named Judge David William Ramsey, he is a judge. So he was sexually exploiting young women in this community for years. In May of 2003, he pled guilty to 5 of 10 charges. He was convicted of 1 count of breach of trust, 1 count of sexual assault causing bodily harm, and 3 counts of buying sex from a child.
That is a bad dude. And he's sitting on the
bench. He is the guy, the authority. And he was dealing with women who were of that age. The way he got caught was he was going to see a woman about a young woman about a custody case with her child, and she recognized that this is the guy who was trying to force himself upon her in a car and then beat her, and she recognized him and ran out of the court. Now, I just want to be clear, I'm not saying that I'm not trying to implicate this man, Judge Ramsey, in these cases of disappearance. I'm just making a point about how these women were maybe seen by some people in the authority.
Yeah, good point. And, you know, there's a few bad apples there, I guess, in the local law enforcement.
You can certainly, that's where you hope, right?
Yeah, just a few. I hope you can get rid of them quick. All right. So there's stuff like that going on. There's a lot happening all around this case that, I mean, all these little bits and pieces that we're telling you about, they all tie in together, with, you know, the original 18 cases and plus the others that we, you know, haven't really discussed or we can't really discuss because we don't know the details. Those have, unfortunately, kind of been lost to time almost, really.
Yeah.
I mean, if they're not on the official EPANA list, they're not getting the attention that these cases are, which, I'll be honest, I mean, it doesn't look like even these are getting a lot because there have been budget cuts at the EPANA office. I mean, I think I said that they had a $5 million budget back in 2006 when they first were formed, or late 2005, I believe. Mm. That has been cut in the 2012 to 2013 year. It was cut down to something like $1.8 million, so a significant
wow.
cut in their funding. And they went down from 70 officers working these cases, they went down to 12 officers work in these cases with support staff. So a much, much smaller task force with the same amount of cases, really, because, you know, we said that there was one arrest made in this whole thing. So that leaves us with 17 cases unsolved. We know of a few people that were involved in this. Now, the one arrest, I guess maybe we should talk about him.
Yeah, because these could be serial, right? So this one arrest could be, you know, at least tied to the other ones.
Well, yeah, it could be tied to the other ones. Now, they do know that he is tied to two murders, this person I'm going to talk about. Now, the arrest that was made is a guy named Gary Taylor Handlin, and he was age 67, or he is age 67. He was arrested for the murder of Monica Jack, who was only 12 years old. That's horrific. Mm. Back in 1978, and another girl who is not an official victim of the Highway 16 murder,
wow.
but he was also convicted of the murder of a girl named Catherine Mary Herbert. And again, not an official Highway of Tears case, but that doesn't mean anything. And see, that shows you that somebody that can be involved in a murder that happens on that, you know, they can be related, I guess.
Yeah,
you know, they could commit one murder that is an official one and one that's not, or 10 others that are not. I mean, that's just the way this is going. So, how was he, you know, finally arrested? I think there was new DNA analysis that was finally available because in 1978 it just wasn't there.
Right.
So this is all the way in
2014,
yeah, and that's Jeez. So 2014. That's not long ago, and EPANA has been around since 2006. Now, that's not the very first break in the case, however.
Right.
There was one other break that came earlier on, and this is maybe a bigger lead. Now, bigger. I mean, of course, we solve one or two murders here. Fantastic. That's
sure.
great work.
Mm.
That's the only officially solved case on the whole list of 18, but. There is another guy that gets involved here in 2012, and again, this is the first break, so it's like 6 years after the task force was assigned. They finally matched DNA from an American serial killer. His name is Bobby Jack Fowler.
Mm-hmm.
They found DNA on the body of Colleen McMillan, who was murdered in 1974. So they hung on to
wow.
DNA evidence from 1974. I mean, they didn't know they were hanging on to DNA evidence.
Sure.
They had evidence. They didn't know what they could do with it. But in 2012, they were finally able to match it up using, the systems where they can input,
right.
you know, the information that automatically matches, you know, ties
DNA
up.
DNA database.
Exactly right. We can talk about those, too, because I think it may be the VICAP system that we're talking about for the match here.
I think you're right.
I think that's the one.
And that's not the only murder he's suspected in.
No. There's others that we talked about this, too, the off-air, Ben. It gets a little bit complicated because, this Bobby Jack Fowler guy, he's a bad dude.
Yeah,
really
he's a
bad dude. He is okay. At the time when that break came, he had been dead for 6 years. So we said that, you know, you're thinking, well, why haven't these cases also been solved? You know, so we're chipping away at the caseload here.
Right.
They're not officially solved because no one was ever tried for the murder. It's like it was an unsolved murder. They can put it to rest and say we know who did this one, and this one.
Mm-hmm.
But you never try that person and find them guilty, officially guilty.
Yeah, especially for the families of these people, there's never that feeling of, oh, we got somebody.
Yeah, exactly. And that's, well, amplified by 100 times for
right.
the ones that never find,
right.
never find their family member. That's gotta be the most, the most heart-wrenching part of this whole thing. And, you know, that documentary that I watched, I gotta say I was tearing up a little bit when they were talking about, you know, some of the families that, they don't have an answer. They never have an answer, and it's never probably going to come. They're not going to find them. So I know it's a dismal way to look at it, but it's not very likely at this point. So this Bobby Jack Fowler guy, can we
right.
talk about him just for
yeah,
a few minutes?
Is that all right? He was a traveling, worked mainly in construction, known for, known throughout the land for being an absolute horrible person.
Yeah, I mean, the way to describe him is he's an American rapist and serial killer.
Right.
Well, alleged serial killer, because he didn't really do time for the serial killing.
Yeah, he traveled all across North America, Florida, Louisiana, Texas, British Columbia. He was charged with murdering a couple in 1969.
Yeah, and got off on just a firearms offense charge.
Right.
So
What?
He murdered two people in 1969 in Texas, I believe, wasn't it?
Yeah,
a man and a woman in Texas. But he was he simply was let go after they gave him a slap on the wrist, basically, for a firearms offense. And I don't know why that would happen.
Is this a wealthy guy?
No. This is a transient construction worker who traveled all over North America, as Ben said. He was, and we have to say alleged serial killer because he, again, never was tried for that specifically, but we do know that he was a murderer.
Right.
And, again, this guy, I mean, we could go on and on and on, and I'll tell you a few more things. He's got an extremely violent past, as you said. He was known as an alcoholic. He was an amphetamine user, a methamphetamine user. He had a long criminal record, extensive criminal record. He liked to drive around, not that this is anything bad, but he'd like to drive around and beat up old cars. I like that, too.
Trolling for hitchhikers.
Yeah, that's the thing. He's trolling for hitchhikers. He's putting lots of miles on those old cars. You know, he's going back and forth between these towns and all these communities. So he sees it... in a way, I guess, almost like a sport. You know, he's going to town. I hate to say it that way, but that's the way these guys are. They're hunting.
Right.
And he's going from town to town, and he can get away with that because of the lifestyle that he's lived his entire life.
Going into bars and motels, things start to fall apart for Fowler in the mid-1990s. In 1995, he's arrested in Newport, Oregon, because a woman that he was trying to tie up, rape, and kill jumps out of the motel window. There's a rope that's tied to her ankle. She survives. She thankfully gets to the police. And that leads to a 1996 conviction of kidnapping, attempted rape, sexual abuse, coercion, assault, and menacing, which I did not know you could get arrested for.
Menacing, sure. Yeah, he's definitely a menacing character. Mm-hmm. So all this is happening, right? He's got all this in his background, his past, and of course they find him in a very unusual situation with this, this woman who's jumped out of a second story window. Clearly something devious is going on there at that point.
Right.
She's scared. They get a DNA sample from him at this point because, you know, now he's captured. He's in the system, I guess.
Yeah.
So he's captured, and he was in there, when did you say, Ben? Was it June of 1995, I believe?
Mm-hmm.
So he's in prison of June of 1995, and there are more murders that happen on the Highway of Tears after June of 1995 when he is in prison already.
Right.
Now, they do match his DNA with we said it was Colleen McMillan, I believe it was. Yeah, they match that from the 1974 victim. So he could have been active on that highway from 1974 all the way through 1995 when he was picked up in June of 95. Now he was in Oregon when he got picked up, so he wasn't in that area, but that's close enough, really. I mean, take a look at a map. It's not that far away. It's not that hard to extrapolate that he could have been there as late as 1995. Now, I think they've only tied him to maybe a couple of these murders.
Right, two others.
Yeah, there's the one, the Colleen McMillan.
Mm-hmm.
That's done.
That's the one solved case.
Well, that's... No, that's not the one. Well, that's the one that's attributed to him officially.
Right.
Okay. But it's not officially solved because he never was tried for it.
Oh, I see.
Not like Gary Taylor.
Right.
Or Hamblin, rather. The ones that Bobby Jack Fowler is considered a prime suspect in, that's another thing. So, of course, we know he's guilty of the Colleen McMillan. We got that, 1974. But back in 1973, there were a pair of murders. One in October, one in November. And the October murder was Gail Ways. And the November murder was Pamela Darlington. And they both, you know, same thing. Right off the highway, both disappeared. I don't know if they were hitchhiking. Yeah, I think one was hitchhiking. Both were actually hitchhiking, trying to get to a local bar, I think it was. And again, he's a strong, strong suspect in those. And many say, and I've heard this, there's a number here. Many say he's tied in with three other victims. You know, there could be others that are, you know, sort of, they're tentative about saying that he's involved. Then others say, no, it's more like 10. There's more like 10 in this region.
Right.
And this gives you a glimpse of just how bad this guy is, because they think that in the United States alone, he may have as many as 20 victims, mm-hmm. but they never caught him for any of them. So this guy got away with it. And he lived in jail for, what, another 10 years, I think? And then he died of lung cancer when
he was 2006.
66. So, you know, even though there's this glimmer of hope that, you know, we know what happened, we can piece it together, we know that, you know, in the early 1970s and possibly as late as the 1990s, he was active on this highway and involved with what's going on. We kind of know what's going on. It gives families just a little bit of closure, but not what they need for sure.
And that's only one of the killers on the Highway of Tears that we know about. We're going to look at some more of the killers, the ones who have been caught in other circumstances, right? The ones who are suspected.
I mean, this is like True Detective style monster, right? This is the kind of guy that you imagine when you imagine a horrible human being.
I'm glad you put it that way, because that's a good visualization of this guy.
Right.
Take a look at his mugshot. If you get a chance, just do a Google search for Bobby Jack Fowler, and you will not be upset by what you see there. It's going to be exactly what you think he looks like. I mean,
okay.
it's awful.
Oh, before we go too deep into the killer stuff, you guys,
yeah.
I do have one interesting, maybe a little bit less grisly trivia fact.
Yes, please.
We were talking off air before when we were making the video about what EPANA stands for. Right?
Ah, yes.
It's a task force, the task force investigating the Highway of Tears. EPANA actually comes from the name of a god in Inuit mythology, which is Pana. And Pana is a god who cares for souls in the underworld.
Oh, cool.
In the afterlife.
Whoa. All right. Very nice.
Before they are reincarnated.
Very nice. So there's a deep meaning behind this task force.
Because I had just kind of assumed that it would be an unnecessarily long acronym.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That's
but
exactly what I thought.
Maybe it's more the U.S. government that does that stuff.
car companies. We know that, Ben.
Oh, and car companies,
yeah, car
too,
companies
yeah.
love to make up acronyms.
So with that brief reflective moment, I guess it's time to dive back into some of the other murderers.
Yeah, you know, and we just kind of wrapped up with Bobby Jack Fowler and how he couldn't have been involved with, you know, this, I guess, a specific set of murders that happened after he was in prison.
Mm-hmm.
And they are careful about laying that out in the cases here. When you read about the 18 that are involved, you know, the ones that are the official cases, they make a special point to say that Fowler was apprehended for crimes in the USA in June of this year and therefore couldn't have been involved with this murder from this point on.
Right.
So what they're saying is everyone up prior to this one, yeah, you know,
maybe.
You never know. I mean, they're saying strong suspect in two of the, you know, there's one that they knew he was involved
right.
in. Strong suspect in the other two, but then others say, we're kind of looking at him for more than just those two.
Well, one of the issues would be then tracing the timeline of that killer's travels.
Yes.
Which is going to be difficult given the time period there.
Well, difficult given his character as well, because
right.
he's
on the fringes of society.
Basically untraceable. I mean, really. As right. close to it as you can get.
So, we have a couple other killers' names. We mentioned Gary Taylor Hanlon.
Yeah, yep.
We have some other people on the docket as well.
Cody Legebakov.
Cody Legebakov, if you are Canadian, then odds are you have heard of this killer. Cody Legebakov, operating in British Columbia, born in 1990,
yeah,
this guy.
He's a young guy. And I want to point this out. None of these were officially Highway of Tears murders, but it shows you that he's operating in the same area.
Right, near Prince George.
Yeah, four victims. And, again, he's really close, but he's not officially involved in this whole thing. So this is the third one that we're talking about here. And then we've got that whole other set of victims that, you know, the four that happened after Fowler was arrested, so that means that there's at least one more operating. So,
right.
so I didn't mean to derail
no,
you here
right.
on Cody, but what have you got about Cody? Because he's also bagged at four murders, and he's
right.
like 21 or something. Jeez.
Yeah, and he was convicted on four counts of first degree murder almost a year ago today, September 11th, 2014. He maintains his innocence and said that he was involved with the murders, but that a drug dealer and two of the drug dealer's friends were the actual murders. And these kind of fanciful tales are often spun in courtrooms by the Disturbed.
Is this the guy that they saw him pulling off of a logging road in his truck?
Right.
The officer pulled him over, asked him about, I don't know if it was like an equipment violation or something. Mm-hmm. Something was wrong. He knew he shouldn't have been there. So he talked to him, realized that he had blood stains on his pants and on his shoes, I think, and shirt and everything. So the officer goes back down the road that he had just, you know, come off of, the one that the truck had just exited from, and he finds the remains of a woman who had just been dumped. I mean, and had been murdered within hours of when he found her. So he caught him red-handed leaving the crime scene. Mm-hmm. And he is saying, I'm not involved in this. It's somebody else.
Original statement regarding the blood on his pants when asked by the police was that he was poaching and he had clubbed a deer to death because, quote, I'm a redneck, that's what we do for fun.
Yeah, and I mean, it doesn't get much more clear than this, that, you know, this is him. He's caught red-handed. He's got, you know, he's got all the evidence on him, around him. The truck is, of course, seized, and, you know, that's loaded with DNA evidence. It's definitely him in this case. Now, there are four women, and I think the oldest one was like 35 years old, which is a bit out of the ordinary for this. For
Highway of Tears.
Yeah, because at this point, the ages range from 12 to 33, so this would have been the oldest person on the list had they been included in the official Highway of Tears list, but they're not. These four are a separate issue.
And this goes to something else. I want to make a note here about the allegations of cover-up, because I neglected to mention this earlier. There has been an actual cover-up in that the Ministry of Transport deleted emails regarding the case. That report comes from an employee there, Tim Duncan. And Tim Duncan said that an aide deleted deleted the emails. So when you hear people talk about a cover-up, that's what they're talking about. It's alleged to be about a dozen emails about meetings with 80 First Nation leaders along the Highway of Tears. And one of the community leaders about this And one of the community leaders, Carrier Sakani Tribal Counselor Mavis Erickson, she says this is part of a continual cover-up, that the emails are kind of a tip of an iceberg thing, because she did not hear about the meetings at all in any shape or form. And she says, I'm going to read this quote, "There's a cover-up going on, and I think this just shows more of that fear that we have, that things are going on and the government wants this whole story to go away. It's been going on for years, and so the destruction of these alleged emails is just more of the same."
You know, Ben, what was the official's name again, the one that supposedly deleted the emails?
Tim Duncan is the one who reported it. He was an executive assistant. He said he was told to delete emails requested under the Freedom of Information Act.
Okay, now, isn't there something a little bit janky about this as well, where he handed the keyboard over to somebody else to actually officially delete the email,
right, so that he can, person's unidentified,
with clear conscience, say, "I never deleted those emails."
Wow. Right.
Although it was under direct request of.
Right.
And you can say and pass a test that says, you know, I didn't officially delete those emails.
And if any, I don't know, that letter versus the spirit of the law kind of stuff is pretty sticky.
Yeah.
But while we're mentioning that note, we should also say that we're not sure why this cover up has occurred. We're not sure why those emails are deleted, other than, you know, often in politics, it's not some grand overarching plot so much as it is a bunch of people trying to look better for promotions.
Well, sure. And, you know, this ties back into, I'll call it conspiracy, but it's not, I don't know if it's really a conspiracy or not. People believe it is, that they're just not paying as much attention to these cases because of the people that are involved in it. They're saying, because it's Aboriginal women, because it's First Nation women, it's not as important as if, the Canadian citizen, the Caucasian Canadian citizens, not the First Nation people, were being murdered at the same rate. If that was happening, you bet there would be extra law enforcement here to take care of this matter. They would be here, you know, in spades trying to make sure that they got this taken care of and wrapped up quick.
I can imagine if the murders were taking place on a highway between, let's say, Vancouver and somewhere else, and the demographics were very different of these victims. Yeah, I can see how it would be seen as a bigger problem, given a lot more attention.
Mm-hmm. And so maybe this is what makes the area attractive to predators. But the fifth and final point that we mentioned in our podcast or in our video earlier is this, and this is what I want to explore toward the end of our show today. It's not just Highway 16. It's not just Highway 5 or Highway 97 or any other Canadian highway, because it's not just Canada. We dug up some stats about the FBI's search for serial killers on the U.S. interstates, didn't we?
Yes, we did. And you know what? I found this fascinating when I dug this up, because I love things like this where it's not known to the public for quite some mm-hmm. time, and then they reveal it, right? I'm sure your audience
yes,
loves that as well.
We do.
So back in 2004, there was a privately launched initiative by the FBI here in the United States, and this was called the Highway Serial Killings Initiative. And the idea was to create a sort of repository for information about serial murders that were happening not just on one highway, but really nationwide here in the United States. Now,
right.
If you haven't heard about this, I mean, this is something that really should be a huge eye-opener for every listener.
Yeah.
That this happens along every highway in the United States. I mean, you take a look at the map of the victims that they talk. So we're not limiting this to just one highway, one mile either way on either side of the highway.
Right.
We're talking about, you know, people that were last seen on or were dumped on the U.S. interstate system. And you can do the same thing for Canada. You can do the same thing for Germany. You can do the same thing in Africa. You can do the same thing anywhere, yeah. wherever. It doesn't matter. This happens worldwide. But the numbers here in the United States, I mean, the numbers are something like they've identified like 600 victims and 275 suspects, you know, fairly quickly.
Right.
That was in the first 5 years of this initiative happening, you know, like with the first 5 years of operation. And that is when they finally went public. They announced in 2009 that they had this initiative.
Mm-hmm.
They said, you know, here's what we found. It's terrifying, but you need to know about this.
Right.
We're tracing some leads.
Yeah. They found this first. The initial inspiration for this came when the Oklahoma State Bureau of Investigation and the Grapevine, Texas Police Department started working together as they recognized a pattern of prostitutes that were found murdered along the I-40 corridor in the South and the Midwest. So they started saying, let's profile.
Yeah.
Who could this be? And the answer was clearly a long-haul trucker.
Yeah, well, yeah, there's several that they've already caught. They've arrested a few. They made a few arrests. And this is what's interesting, is they found a couple of truckers working together, I guess,
right.
as a serial killer team on the highways, mm-hmm. which is terrifying. But one that stands out, I guess, would be Robert Ben Rhodes. And Robert Ben Rhodes is, again, another character along the lines of Fowler as far mm-hmm. as just how awful of a human being this person is. He's a long-haul trucker from Houston, Texas, and he spent 15 years torturing and killing women in the cab of his truck as he traveled across the United States. So This is a huge, huge problem. I mean, for many, many reasons, but so this is like just a small fraction of what's happening, well, worldwide, of course, but also on the Highway of Tears. And you can take that, you know, extrapolate that to what's happening on highways across the United States and all across Canada. The numbers are enormous. I think there's something like 1,200 missing or murdered Aboriginal women across Canada from, like, I think it's like mid-1980 up until 2012 or something like that. It's a big, big number.
Mm-hmm.
Here we've accounted for, you know, with the FBI task force, something like 600. I think there's got to be more than that. I'm sure that there are. But the problem, you know, these long-haul truck drivers like Robert Ben Rhodes, and there's another one, his name is Bruce Mendenhall, who was an Illinois trucker. He was, I think he's finally busted after he murdered a murdered a 25-year-old truck stop prostitute in Tennessee, and police found a sack of bloody clothing in his truck cab. At, you know, at the time,
right.
he had just committed this murder. Later, they found blood from five additional women in the same cab of that truck. So that means that, you know, that's six victims for him. Rhodes, I don't remember exactly off the top of my head, but, you know, DNA evidence in his truck counted to, you know, led to many, many of these missing victims. It's a huge problem for law enforcement because it's like a mobile crime scene. They're comfortable in their in the cab of their truck. That's their comfort zone.
Their lair.
Yeah, exactly right.
Right.
And I read somewhere, I think it was a guy named Jack Levin. He's an author of a book called Mass Murder: America's Growing Menace, way back in 1985. And it's basically not the first, but one of the first books about serial killers that was widely published, widely read. And he kind of laid down some
definitions.
Elements of what a highway killer might operate like or might be like. And he said that, you know, they tend to stick to established comfort zones. You know, this is serial killers in general, but these guys, their comfort zone is the cab of their truck.
Right.
And I think that's what's happening on the Highway of Tears as well. But the comfort zone is right there, and they stop at a truck stop, they pick up a prostitute, you know, with the promise to take her to the next town as well.
Sure.
She gets in, and that's the last anybody ever sees of her.
Or just hitchhikers, because Rhodes would pick up couples, immediately kill the male, and keep the female.
Yeah, see, Jesus. Devious, but it's awful what happens, but then they drive them into another jurisdiction, you know, which could be 100 miles away, could be 500 miles away, and dump the body. And then they see it as somebody that is possibly just a transient because, you know, we have no recognition of who this is. We don't have any kind of prints on file. We don't know anything about this victim. So that's the problem, is that with such great distance between all these cases happening, the disappearance and then the actual, you know, the turning up of the body, it's really a difficult situation for them to solve. And even given systems like, you know, the VICAP system or Canadians' version of that, which is called the VICLASS system, which is a violent criminal, system that ties together people with DNA information and fingerprints and photographs and, the last known whereabouts and all that.
It's like it's an electronic evidence matcher.
Yes, exactly right. And that's been around since the 1980s, but there's a problem with that. So you can see all these hurdles that they're trying to, overcome here. And the problem the biggest problem with that VICAP system that I'm talking about, again, this is a violent criminal apprehension program. So you'd think that this would be something that is mandatory. It's not mandatory.
For law enforcement.
For law enforcement in a situation where there's a murder. Now, so this goes back to the 1980s again. They're trying to find patterns of, you know, these complex multi-jurisdictional murders. So you think that, you know, this would be a super effective tool, and it can be. It can be very helpful. But the problem is you have to have enforcement officers that do the due diligence to put the information in and get the system to work the way that it should, and then someone to analyze it and make sure that they're reading it correctly.
Well, I see that, but I also think that part of the problem we should factor in isn't just manpower, it's ultimately expense.
Yeah, because it's a 16-page form that they have to fill out. Now, how long do you think it takes an officer to fill out a 16-page form with detailed investigation information, or, you know, information about a particular homicide?
And not all the law enforcement agencies play nice together.
No, exactly right. And that's the other frustrating thing, is it's like, you know, butting your head against a wall because you can't get the other guys to talk to you when you need them to. And not only that, there's things that they may know that they don't know as part of they don't understand as part of this case. And if they were ever to talk, and sometimes that's what happens, they accidentally stumble across some information that they say, wait a minute, that you just struck a nerve with me. Hang on a second. They go through their box of files and find, you know, whatever it is, or, you know, probably electronic information. But it's these chance occurrences that sometimes lead to solving these. But if this system were to work the way that it should, I mean, it's a well laid out system, the VICAP system and the VICLASS system in Canada, and other places have similar systems for violent criminals, but if they could just get it all to work together, if they could get somebody to analyze the information correctly, if they could, you know, there's a lot of ifs in this story. But if they could do that, they might make some headway on some of these cases.
So here's the worst thing for me. You have to get caught first one time for something in order to even be in that system, right?
True.
So if you're like Bobby Fowler and you just haven't gotten caught for a long time, then you don't, it doesn't even
matter.
Well,
he was repeatedly arrested for other things.
Sure, but unless he was arrested for something that would specifically put him in that violent crime database, right?
Then
right.
True. And what I was talking about, that 16-page form is for particular characteristics of a homicide.
Right.
And so, you know, there's lesser versions of that. So, like, you may input him in the system and say, this guy is an alcoholic who likes to fight at the local bar. He got, you know, busted for breaking a bottle and stabbing somebody in the arm with it, you know. But, you know, I don't know what charge that would come with, but that's what he's in the system as. Not necessarily as, hey, we caught this guy, he's suspected of, you know, being a serial killer. So I guess it really depends on just, you know, how much effort they put into correctly categorizing these people when they put them in the system.
It's vital, however. I mean, and sorry to bust in. I don't want to interrupt what you guys are saying, but it's vital for this sort of stuff to be done. At last count, I think there was an investigation discovery piece on this. There are 25 former long-haul truckers currently in prison for serial murder.
Wow. That's a significant number.
That's a hell of a big number.
That is a big number. Now, I know that you're saying 25, and we're saying that's a huge number because they're responsible for more than one just by nature of being serial killers. Yeah, and that's occurring over a period longer than a month. So multiple victims longer than a month. That means these guys are out there for a long time doing this, who knows how many.
And, of course, we are required to say, of course, we're going to point this out. The vast majority of people in the world, let alone truckers, are honest, hardworking people who are just trying to get a buck. But we're talking about I think that it's more fair to say that these people who are using the veneer of being a trucker are not actually they're killers.
Yeah. Yeah,
that's their primary vocation.
And this is the way that they get to do what they do.
Right.
And they find it, you know, if they were to eliminate that from their life, you know, the trucking part of their life, they wouldn't be able to do this. And, mm-hmm. And they're never going to give that up. So one last thing I guess that I need to add is that,
sure.
You know, looking into all these numbers, and we said 25 have been, you know, convicted of being serial killers or that are known serial killers that, the FBI has captured. They say that, you know, the numbers are just enormous. You know, how many they believe are out there on the highways.
Right.
Now, I've seen numbers that range, well, there's a huge range.
Yeah.
Some will say, you know, we think that at any given point there's 67 serial killers working the highway systems at any given time. Others may say 300 and everything in between. So it's a huge, huge number, and I don't think a lot of people really know that this is happening out on the highways. And it's not just the U.S., it's not just Canada, it's not just Europe, it's all over the world. It's happening. So use some caution, really. I mean, when I started reading about all this stuff, it really is an eye-opener.
Yeah.
I mean, it makes you fear for anybody traveling. You know, you want to be very diligent about, you know, checking in and knowing where they're going to be and when they're going to be there, and it
definitely distorts my memories now of running around, you know, sometimes truck stops, sometimes rest stations along the highway system in the U.S.
Sure.
Yeah, I used to sleep at rest stops in my car because I had I had my day trip or road trip map about how far I could go.
Uh-huh.
And I would arrange that by, you know, I would arrange that by where I could stop at a park or at a rest stop. And we haven't even talked about disappearances in national parks, which may be a podcast for another day. But the truth of the matter, listeners, is that there exists more than one level of a culture. The U.S., the world that most of us know if we live here, is more like the top layer of an onion. There are people who just travel from national park to national park. There are killers who just travel up and down I-40. And I know it sounds alarming, and it is. But unlike some alarmist things, this is terrifying because it is true. Now, Matt, earlier off the air, you said that you had one more thing that we should end on. Is that correct?
I did. I was going to wait a second. Are you getting that too? Is it just my headphones or are you guys getting that?
No, I hear it too. Some sort of almost like the sound of a truck rolling through the distance.
But also drums.
But also drums.
I know,
I hear stuff. What's going on with you?
Hey, everybody.
Oh, hi, Noel.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is super producer Noel Brown. That music always means, of course, it is time for our Moment with Noel. Hey, man, how are you doing?
Ben, Matt, Scott.
You're making some serious eye contact with us as you were saying our names.
This is creepy.
I'm well. Thank you for asking.
Yeah, so did you catch what we were talking about?
I'm going to have to be, like, really honest with you. This is one of the rare situations where I've actually been jumping up and down and going to the other studio and doing other things. Mm-hmm. So I actually have no idea what this episode was about.
Well, hey.
Well,
okay.
You should check it.
Give me the clips.
Check it out.
Well, I will when I edit it. I'm sure.
We started talking about a thing called the Highway of Tears.
Got it.
I'm not going to go too in depth in it.
Well, let's just recap the whole thing.
We just did a show on it.
Yeah. No.
Back in 1969.
Yeah.
You guys, I heard snatches here. I get that. Okay.
We had to.
The case a little bit.
You know, we had to ask Scott on because this is something that is related both to the automotive world and to the true crime world.
And Scott's also kind of a stand-up guy, so.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh, shucks.
Yeah, hey, no, you're 8 out of 10. No, I'm just kidding.
I just had to, really fast bring something up, and apropos of nothing, I have to say that every time I see the notes that Scott Benjamin takes and the way that he takes them and arranges them, every time I see it, I am thoroughly impressed. Not only that you function in that way, but that there's so much detail going on here. So it's this yellow, I guess that's notebook paper.
That's a legal pad.
Yes, it's a legal pad, and then there are post-it notes all over it with, like, pointing to things to say, okay, this is where we go from here, this is how we get to here. I love it.
It's, that's, you know, a leftover from back in my days of, like, floor directing, you know, for video shoots and things, because you had to walk your way through a complex script or something that, you know, you don't shoot in order, mm-hmm. so you have to map all that stuff out ahead of time, and I find that's the way that I work best, so I just kind of carry it over into the podcast as well.
That's
great.
Thank you.
No, I have to ask.
Sometimes I'll see Scott just standing at the window writing on the window panes with a grease pencil.
Uh-huh. Just red rum over and over again. So I have to ask though, mm-hmm. Noel, we talked about this, and this is a question for everybody. Does this affect your earlier conversation or the earlier conversations we've had about hitchhiking? This whole idea of, this whole truth about the amount of serial murderers getting away scot-free, no offense, on the interstates.
I mean, I didn't need anything to affect my outlook on, you know, picking up hitchhikers, but sure. Yeah.
You're pretty adamant about
it. Yeah. I think, a little bit of healthy paranoia is probably good for the old self-preservation game, I would say. That's just me. Call me, jaded, but I'll get mad at you if you call me jaded.
I've never once called you jaded.
Yeah, no, definitely not jaded.
He's jaded a little bit, guys, but we all are. It's okay.
I don't know. I would say optimistic.
That's fair.
That's fair.
That's fair.
But what about you, Sky? Definitely.
Well, you know, I was already kind of skittish about it anyways, should you not. But the cases that we're talking about, it's always that the bad guy is the one that's picking up the hitchhiker.
Yeah.
It's not the other way around. It's not that the hitchhiker is the bad person. And those cases happen as well, where you pick up a bad dude on the side of the road and something horrible happens, to either an individual or family or whatever. But this is like the opposite of that. So it kind of gives me like even more just information in my head that's swimming around. Like, this is just a bad deal. Don't pick up a hitchhiker.
No.
Don't hitchhike.
In our earlier Car Stuff podcast, which you can check out, listeners, if you're interested in hearing more about hitchhiking, in our earlier podcast on this, we talked a little bit about the rise of hitchhiking being associated with counterculture in the 60s, right? Mm-hmm. And how I think it might have been the FBI, but government agencies propagated this idea that, stoned hippies were going to kill you because stoners are notoriously furious, impulsive.
They're also sex hungry.
Go-getters. Right, yeah. And so how much of that is fear culture and how much of it is healthy skepticism? Now, of course, I also think you have to exercise judgment. My girlfriend, as I think I mentioned on Car Stuff, has banned me from picking up hitchhikers.
Rightfully so.
I just like strangers.
Me too, but Ben, there are other ways. You can meet strangers all over the place, man.
It's a hazardous activity. That's what he's saying.
I mean, everybody's kind of a stranger. You don't really know someone, do you?
Wait. I've only, like, seen Scott a couple of times.
That's true.
Oh, come on.
like, every day.
Become the bad guy here.
Yeah. Well, let's end before we start accusing each other of various murders. Guys, I know this was a long podcast, but we hope that you, I don't know if enjoyed it is the right word, but we hope that you found it interesting.
Can I just say something?
Yes.
I know that we say this every time on Car Stuff, but we try to put out so much information, so many little bits and pieces here. We try to tie it together the best we can. You know, we're using these complex notes that Matt told you about.
Sure.
But you'd be doing yourself a big favor if you were to search it and read about it yourself, because that way it just kind of makes a little more sense. It might be laid out in a way that makes more sense to you. But hopefully we got to the main points and at least open your eyes to a problem that's happening and maybe even just kind of give you that little bit of, I guess maybe a little bit of fear when you're out there on the highway that, you know, just be cautious.
Be aware.
And awareness. I think awareness is one of the biggest issues with these things. Just if more people knew that it existed, I feel like it becomes a part of zeitgeist, and then we can actually put, you know, if enough people care about something, it will get the presence that it needs, the maybe even the funding that it needs.
Sure, and right. I mean, fear. I shouldn't have said fear. Maybe awareness.
Awareness
is
sure.
a much better way to say
well,
that.
There's. Okay, I feel like this is the most important point, and so I held on to this for a while, but just to be absolutely clear for everyone listening to this, whether you are involved in some way with the Highway of Tears or whether this is a story you've heard for the first time, our collective hearts go out to the victims. There are more than 18, and a bureaucratic division does not change that fact. And we hope that the law enforcement folks, who are often outnumbered by problems and beset by red tape, we hope that their work pays off, because these people are busting their humps, and it's time for these families to have closure, if at all possible.
Well said, Ben.
Agreed. So if you have any thoughts on the Highway of Tears or anything else that we've talked about in this podcast, you can find us on Facebook and you can find us on Twitter. We are Conspiracy Stuff at both of those. You can also find us on, there are all these places you can find us. We even have a SoundCloud account if you want to listen to the Stuff They Don't Want You to Know theme song over and over.
That's not real, is it?
It's real.
It's a real thing, a SoundCloud?
Yeah, SoundCloud.
Oh, come on.
What? Yeah. It's a cloud of sound. It's beautiful.
I love it when Scott says stuff like that.
Yeah.
I know. I take a lot of ribbing around here for stuff like that, but come on. SoundCloud, that's not a thing.
Whoa. Look, it was a great idea when it came out. It was a way to upload your music so people could stream it for free for indie artists, okay? Got to stand up for SoundCloud.
One of my favorite Benjamin lines is the time where I think he got a little bit irritated with one of our coworkers, Allison. Well, not really irritated, but you were saying, she said, Scott, but you don't have any apps on your phone? And she said, what? An app? What am I going to do with an app?
You show me an app that does something for me, and I'll download it.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
How often do you tweet, by the way?
Ben takes care of the tweets.
Yeah. Scott's got the Facebook.
Well, look, if you send things, you can also send things to CarStuff. Is it at CarStuff,
HSW? Yeah.
And on Twitter, and you can also find them on Facebook. That's where you're going to find Scott. Any other places that they should look for you, Scott?
Our website, I guess, carstuffshow.com.
Mm-hmm.
Excellent. Same deal with Stuff They Don't Want You Know? You're going to find audio podcasts, some videos, blogs, all that stuff?
Mm-hmm. All that stuff. And, of course, if you have any topic that you would like us to check out in the future, please feel free to reach out to us directly. Our best ideas come from you.
And if you have those ideas and you don't like the social media, kind of like Scott, you can send us an email. We are
conspiracy@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this topic and other unexplained phenomena, visit youtube.com/conspiracy stuff. You can also get in touch on Twitter at the handle @conspiracy stuff.